listening to Alien X Radio, and this is your afternoon interview. Online right now, I have my guest, writer and director, Tom McLaughlin. How you doing tonight, sir?
I'm doing fine.
That is awesome.
How are you guys doing?
Doing pretty good, hanging out here in the chat room and stuff. Everybody's been waiting to hear from you today. I mean, a lot of people, and they're really Friday the 13th fans, big time.
Great. Well, I'm kind of moving like Jason today. I was a little slower on the uptake than normal, but Jason always gets there eventually.
That's right. No matter how slow he goes, he's always catches up to you.
Yeah, like the mummy. You know, those things.
Awesome. I've been billing you as the director all week long, and I was leaving out writer, that you were the writer of this script as well.
Yeah, yeah, that was part of why I wanted to do it, because they actually gave me Frank Mancuso, who was running the whole Jason franchise there at Paramount, kind of gave me free rein. He said, two things, we got to bring back Jason. And if you want to put comedy in it, just don't, make fun of him. And I said, I can do that. So my whole objective was to really have it be a very gothic horror movie, because I wanted to bring Jason back like Frankenstein or the Bolt of Lightning. And from that point on, anything goes. I mean, and every kill in that thing was like superhuman, so that, figuring, he doesn't need to just stab people, he can cut off three heads at once or bend a guy backwards and break him or tear off somebody's head. I mean, it's, he's now an unstoppable thing. So
yeah, I think one of my favorite ones,
that movie,
my favorite one, one of my favorite ones was the face through the wall of the camper.
Oh yeah.
That was freaking awesome. All the sound of it, like crunching and cracking as the metal was bending out. That was kind of inventive. That was pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, I wrote most of it in the cemetery, Hollywood Forever Cemetery out here. And then what I didn't do there, I did under the Christmas tree at home, because it was all done, during December as I was writing the thing. And, so it was, I sort of pull from things that are emotional and things that you kind of care about, and then obviously go into the bigger than death, type kills. I mean, it's all about, like a merry-go-round, gone crazy. It starts and then it takes off, and then next thing you don't know if you're going to make it.
Right. So this was pretty much the first one that started to introduce a little of that side comedy. Like you said, it didn't really revolve around Jason himself. It was the things that the teenagers were doing before Jason even entered the picture.
Yeah, well, they all had, there's always comic characters. It's sort of like a staple. There's the the crazy wild guy. In fact, I think he was part three, I think, that the guy, the prankster guy, was the one who brought the hockey mask.
Right, right. Shelley, I believe his name was.
And then, because it's just, the first one, you never saw him. It was the mom, and, saw him at the end. And then the second one, he was like Elephant Man, the bag over his head.
Right.
And then I believe it was the third one, the 3D, that introduced the hockey mask. But they all had some kind of comedy. But I wanted to go, kind of tongue-in-cheek with it, kind of showing, what you were going to get style-wise with, the shot of Jason walking across like James Bond, for the opening titles and slashing instead of shooting. And that, to me, it was sort of that kind of homage to A. Bond, who I loved and was like, one of my first movie heroes. And also just the fact that this is a, franchise that just doesn't stop, just like, the Bond movies. So, it was sort of in that spirit that I wanted to do the film, so that, it remained fun no matter what.
It's neat that you said like the Bond movies, because when I first seen it, that opening scene, and it cuts to like the close-up of the person's eyeball, and then you see Jason walk out and do
right.
That swipe. That right there is so much 007 kind of beginning of a movie.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
Much, yeah. So that was one of the things where when I first seen that movie, I was like, oh boy, here we go. It's going to be a comical ride, just the way it opened up. But yeah, like you said, the Jason stays as scary and as serious as he always has been. So that was a good balance between those two. And I noticed that that was also when we changed our Tommies, right? We got a different Tommy, which was Tom Matthews was his name?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. John Shepherd, who had done the previous one, you know, there's so many stories. I don't know what the true story is, but I had heard that he just wasn't interested in, you know, in doing another one. And then later I heard that it was more of a financial thing and, you know, who knows, you know, who to believe. But I was very fortunate to get Tom Matthews because I thought he was just terrific. And, you know, he understands comedy. And, you know, he's a, you know, good looking hero kind of guy. And yet ultimately, it was about the, you know, the girl saving the day. When it could see things to me like Sigourney Weaver in Alien. But, you know, when the woman can be this tough and somehow win out in the end, to me, it's even more interesting.
And that opening graveyard scene too, where they're going into, dig up and they're ultimately trying to burn and destroy Jason's remains. I'm really bad with some actors' names, but all I can say is Arnold Horshack.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I couldn't believe when I saw him. I came out of my chair. I love Arnold Horshack. Oh. Was he like a nutbag on, because I've seen him in other things where he was being interviewed and he was kind of crazy. Was he crazy on the set, like just out there?
Well, no. He was quite somber, quite serious. I wanted to get as much of his sort of comic timing in there, but yeah, he definitely wasn't, you know, doing the character. We just lost Ron actually about 6 months ago or so, which is very sad. I think it's the first of the actors that are in my particular movie that have passed on. But he was very, very loved because of that TV show, and he was terrific to work with. But yeah, no, he wasn't. I don't think anybody was that wild and zany on the set. To be honest, I think everybody was enjoying it, and we were all young and crazy, and we were up all night. All that was 6 days a week. We had one day off, and you know, it was all nights. So we were all like living like vampires, and sleeping during the day.
Yeah, you can't have Jason killing everybody in the daytime all the time.
No, we did it one sequence. You know, we did at the very opening. Where he was like, kind of walking through the forest. But what I wanted to do and wasn't able to do successfully is I wanted a completely burned out forest. I wanted him walking through, you know, black remains of trees and stuff. And we searched all over and couldn't find it. So we found kind of an area that was somewhat sparse and we darkened a couple of trees. But, you know, the whole thing with Jason is that, you know, there's got to be that sense that he's not in direct bright sunlight. So it was trying to play that down, the daylight, as much as we could. But we needed it for the, you know, the transition into the next day.
Sure, he's got to have his backdrop. I mean, you can't have Jason walking through Walmart and be scary.
Yeah, plus he needed, you know, for me, he needed his arsenal. And, you know, coming up out of the grave, you know, he had the spear that Tommy had ran through him. And then, he left that in one of his early victims, and so now he needed stuff, and just so happened there's paintball guys out there, and, that got him a belt and a machete and all kinds of fun things. So that was sort of the purpose, too, for doing it during the day.
And you actually put that together in a way that some of the movies I always wondered, like, okay, how did that guy get that weapon? He didn't have anything a moment ago. Now all of a sudden he has something. And you like you said, you made it. You had the guy out there that was paintballing. He was mad because he already got killed in the paintball war, and he's got the machete, and that's how he gets it. You know, I like the way that actually gets put out there, so that you're not just, oh, okay, he just found it.
Of course, there's the Jason touches. He's got to not just take the machete. He's got to tear the guy's arm off and remove the arm, so he can now have what he wants.
Yeah, for sure. Speaking of, you had mentioned that spear. Now, when the Volkswagen Bug pulls up, okay, and he rams it through the fender, you know, busts out the tire, and then when he actually slams that through that front window, it looks like the actress jumps to the right, and the spear goes right to the right and looks like it gets her. I mean, was that close? I mean, did that hit her in some way or what?
You're sure you didn't listen to the commentary? Yeah, that's one of the famous stories, actually, about the movie. That actress, actually, is my wife, Nancy.
Really?
And, yes.
You were in trouble.
Put her in this position. This was, like, very early on when we got C.J. Graham, who was playing Jason, who replaced the very first actor that was doing Jason in the daytime sequences only. And CJ was a Marine. And, you know, anytime I told him anything, it was like, yes, sir. I said, don't call me sir, I'm Tom. Yeah, yes, sir, I won't. You know, So I instructed him, you know, we have this windshield and it's breakable, but we only have one of them because we have no budget. So, you know, we can only do this once, but she's going to be there on the driver's side. And, you know, on action, you know, you can't move your arm back so she can, you know, feel you're about to come and then go right at that seat. And she's going to get out of the way. Well, the Marine in him just, you know, as I said, action, he just saw his target and he went right with it. I mean, it was just like natural instinct and just barely missed her. Mm. And it was one of those moments where it was a hell of a shot. Of course, we weren't going to do it again. But I said, CJ, I don't know. He goes, I'm sorry, sir. I am so sorry. I said, don't call me sir. But that coupled with then putting Nancy down in the mud puddle, and she had a breathing device which wasn't working correctly, so she was sucking up a lot of good, you know, Georgian earth there. We were shooting in Georgia.
I thought for sure that was a fake body.
It was a tough ride for her, but a very memorable sequence.
Wow. Yeah, I bet it's very memorable, like every time you do something. Hey, remember that time you almost got me killed?
Yeah.
I'm sure she brings it up all the time. Oh, boy.
Yeah, she does, as a matter of fact.
So, clearly, that I would imagine that's probably one of your favorite stunts. What other stunts were just really cool to set up?
Well, the big one, the last shot of the entire movie was the motorhome, where that goes airborne. And, you know, trying to find a stuntman to do that, I mean, it sounds very simple. You know, we're used to, you know, seeing cars fly in the air and all that now, and you know, and a lot of, some of them are CGI, and some of the guys actually got these great air cannons and stuff. But we had a ramp, and we had a good old boy down there who showed up in a Evel Knievel-type jumpsuit, and he says, you know, I'm ready to do it, sir. And, you know, we were just praying, because we had, you know, obviously one motor home, and this, you know, had to be, you know, good. I mean, this was a, you know, big moment. And so that was probably the most nerve-wracking, and the sun was coming up, and, you know, it was, you know, we did not know if we were going to make it, and boy, he, you know, he hit that thing twice as fast as he was supposed to, and that, you know, thing flew. But it was one of those moments where, when everything stopped, it's like, please, God, don't have him dead. Please don't let him hurt at all. And he jumped up out of the back, and he goes, that's good. Did you like it? And I was like, yes, we loved it. So that was, a, you know, probably the most nerve-wracking thing. The toughest stuff was the underwater things, because obviously we couldn't shoot in a real lake for the underwater things, so we ended up going into my parents' pool to shoot the whole thing where Jason's head gets chopped up, and then all the stuff prior to that with the fighting on top of the water was all done at USC in their pool, and just kind of darken everything around so that we could get, you know, the various shots of Jason and Tommy fighting in the boat. So, you know, again, kind of just tricky use of three different locations.
How long was the shooting schedule? I mean, just the initial photography, you know, not the post stuff, but just the, filming
development. I want to say like 32, 34 days, something like that.
Really?
I know my first movie, One Dark Night, we had 28 days, and I know I thought, well, this is at least better. But then what happened, actually, is we came back, we cut the picture together, we had this incredibly wild preview at Paramount Studios. They brought in people from, you know, shopping centers and malls and, you know, going to movie theaters, you know, do you want to go see the next Friday? And this was a party hardy crowd, and they stood in line for 4 hours before coming into the studio to see it. And it was a solid, it was like a rock concert. It was solid noise through the entire thing. This audience never shut up, going crazy through the whole film. When the whole thing was over, Frank turned to me and he said, we need three more kills. I said, what? He said, yeah, we need three more kills. I said, but I got 13 kills. That was part of my thing. I wanted 13 kills. It happened on Friday the 13th. No, we need three more kills. I said, okay. So that's what we went off and, you know, then created the scene where you saw the one of the counselors, Sissy, get her head twisted off and kill the caretaker, the graveyard caretaker. And then I said, you know, how about if I give you four kills? And I did a double, you know, spearing through two people out having a romantic, you know, rendezvous out in the forest. So, you know, that was all added in and it took, you know, put two more days onto the schedule.
Wow. Awesome, though, overall. I mean, just it's truly a classic movie. I mean, I like all of the Friday the 13th. I really do, because I've watched them, you know, since I was little. I remember going to the drive-in after part 1, 2, and 3 were out, and they had they had played all three of them at the drive-in. My parents taking me and my brother and my sisters out to the drive-in. We would take lawn chairs with us and sit outside the car and everything. We watched all three of them. Well, I watched most of all three of them. I was covering my eyes. I was little.
Yeah, I've always loved horror movies. I don't know. I've always related to the monsters. Maybe I felt like, you know, that's me, you know, the freak, the monster, the person that's never going to be loved, the person that's going to, you know, wander around in the moonlight. So it was, you know, really interesting to be able to, you know, actually do one of the classic 80s monsters. You know, growing up on the Universal monsters, you know, Frankenstein, Dracula, Wolfman, you know, watching them on TV as a kid, you know, that was deep in my bones. So there's a lot of sly references to those, you know, those inspirations in the movie. But then, you know, to actually get in there and, you know, get a chance to, you know, to do Jason. And later I got to do Freddy on Freddy's Nightmares, the TV series, and then do a Stephen King movie. I sort of covered, you know, the big, you know, monsters or monster creators, horror creators with Stephen King. Of the 1980s, so that, you know, for me, it was a wonderful, you know, chance to kind of go back and do the stuff that, you know, you loved as a kid, but, you know, obviously, and, you know, that style of the day, the way we were doing it, and somewhat tame compared to where things have gotten now with, you know, the torture porn things, which I guess has calmed down, and then we kind of went, you know, back into a very simple thing, too, with the found footage stuff with Blair Witch and Paranormal Activity and things where there's no blood, you know, really at all. And yet, you know, it works for audiences. So it's the genre, you know, continues on. It's just a question of us trying to find new ways of scaring the audience.
Oh, yeah. You got to come up with something new. You can't go, oh, saw that in part 5 of Friday the 13th. Oh, saw that in Nightmare on Elm Street part 6. You know, you can't, it's got to get to a point where it's just kind of hard to figure out new ways to maim and destroy people.
Yeah, my favorite actually of all of Fridays was the first one because, you know, it had that wonderful surprise that it was, you know, the mother, you know, woman doing all those killings. And then as far as the Jason movies, part 4, because, you know, it looked like that was going to be the wrap up, the final chapter, you know, I thought they did a great job on that. And I sort of skipped over 5 because it wasn't really Jason, you know.
Right.
You
know, I argue with people about that all the time. I argue with them all the time. So that is not Jason.
Yeah. So, you know, I just sort of picked up where, you know, 4 left off. And so basically this was, an extension of after Tommy gets out of the mental institution at the end of 4. And then there's been some, you know, interesting things that have happened, you know, since that with the character going into outer space and Manhattan. And, you know, they actually, Frank Mancuso, when he finished this, you know, he said, what do you think about Jason meets Freddy? I said, are you serious? And he goes, yeah. I go, well, how do you do that? That's with New Line. He goes, yeah, I don't know. I mean, but I'm going to try to see if we can do that. I think that would be great. But it didn't work out until obviously years later. And then, you know, he said, how about Jason meets Cheech and Chong? I said, that I like, you know, like Abbott and Costello meet Frankenstein. I said, then they could be funny. Jason could be serious. And, you know, you could probably take it another level. But you know,
Jason's
that never
not here,
either.
Man. Jason's not here, man.
I just love the idea of them being stoned and out there. And, you know, I don't know.
Yeah. You were talking earlier about the classic horror monsters and you're paying homage to them. My producer, Michael Klinkenbeard, he told me to ask you about Karloff Market.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's it. Yeah. That's one of them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the streets that they were driving down, I mentioned, are also in terms of the more recent horror stuff. One's Carpenter, you know, for John Carpenter. Right. Another was Craven. There was Sheriff Garris was a reference to my good friend Mick Garris, who does all the Stephen King movies and things. I can't think of all the stuff, but I had stuff just, you know, in through all that gave little, you know, tiny subtle tributes for the people that caught it. They're these different people either in my life or, you know, inspirational.
Awesome. Now, Jay Crimson, he's in my chat room right now. He's in a band called No Class Assassins, and they're going to be one of my guests in a show coming up. And they're in there saying that him and his bass player both say that that particular movie, Part 6, was their favorite out of the entire series.
Wow, that's wonderful.
So,
thank you.
So there you go with that. And they're in a band, too, so I think they'd be interested in knowing that you yourself are a bit of a guitar plucker.
Well, not a guitar plucker. I'm the lead singer in a group called The Sloth, like one of its seven deadly sins, Sloth. And, you know, the group actually was created back in 1965, and as the group was sort of changing and evolving, then I got involved with a couple of the Sloth members, so we were all sort of out of that same period, but the original guys recorded a song called Making Love, and it's basically like a kind of a bow diddly beat, but they did it really like crazy jungle style, and it's really raw and raunchy, and, you know, just by the title alone, Making Love, it was not going to get airplay, you know, in 65. So, you know, they made a number of records on their own. They tried to get it played, and then the group broke up, and some of the members and I continued and kind of evolved into different groups, you know, through, at least for me, up until 1969. And then I decided that, you know, I wanted to be a more visual lead singer because these, you know, were the days, obviously, of, you know, we were playing with the Doors, we were playing with Eric Burdon and the Animals, you know, Love, you know, always, of course, anytime the Stones came to town, I mean, you just, these were our heroes. But I felt I wanted to do something different as a lead singer, and somebody said, did you ever study mime? And I didn't even know what the word was, and then Marcel Marceau came to Los Angeles. And suddenly, at 19, I decided I'm going to go to Paris and study mime, which I did, which was an incredibly bizarre, you know, choice to make when you don't speak French or anything else, and don't know anybody. But it was one of those kind of life-changing things of being, you know, there and, you know, realizing, gee, this is something I can actually do, and I can do comedy. And that kind of took me kind of away from rock and roll and into physical comedy and being monsters, and I was Captain Star in The Black Hole for Disney, and I mean, pretty much anything that required, you know, some sort of person with physical training, i.e. a mime, you know, I would get those kinds of roles. And eventually that led to me being, you know, writing stuff and then, you know, obviously directing movies. And then about a year and a half ago, we find out that this I get a call from a lawyer. It turns out the lawyer was the guy in the band with me. And he says, do you realize that song that the Sloths did, Making Love, is selling on eBay for $6,650 per original, you know, 45? And I went, wow, what does that mean? He says, well, it means people, you know, just found out the Sloths, you know, that some of the guys are still alive and around. They want to do an interview. And so we, you know, we interviewed for this magazine called Ugly Things, a rock publication, and one thing led to the other, and, you know, somebody said, well, why don't we get together and just jam in a garage like we used to, because we were, you know, one of the original garage bands. And those were the days when, you know, that's where you, you know, you played as a 15, 16-year-old. And from that garage stuff, we just said, you know, well, we got enough songs, let's go and play somewhere. I know we're going to be terrible, but it somehow clicked. It worked. And since, well, as I said, about a year and a half ago, you know, the Sloths have been playing like nonstop. And, you know, we've gone from gig to gig. We're going over to Europe at the end of the year.
Awesome.
Tons of fans that know the record because it was put on a compilation called Back from the Grave in the 80s. So, you know, we find there's people internationally that, you know, that know the group. And we're doing the big Ponderosa Stomp in New Orleans in October. And, you know, a lot of festivals and things. And it's been an amazing thing to suddenly go back and do something that was your dream when you were 15, you know, but to be doing it in your early 60s is a trip. Right. And, you know, we're going at it with the same energy, you know, still, you know, that same kill or be killed attitude of, you know, very punk, very, you know, very, very, you know, heavy, you know, pedal to the metal type rock and roll. And, you know, it's just been a blast.
Well,
so,
I do happen to have a copy here of Making Love. And,
oh, great.
Yeah, I'm going to play that. And I'm sorry to tell you, though, I did not spend $6,650 on it.
Good.
Yeah.
No, they remastered it and put it out on vinyl again, you know, for the wonderful price of about $9. So
right.
Available.
It's that original pressing's going for the big money.
I don't know. Do you want to play that record? I mean, you spend over $6,000. You're going to play it? You're just going to look at it?
Hell no. That goes in a plastic, nice, airtight, and it gets put away out of the sunlight even. Air-cooled container. I'm going to go ahead and play that tune for everybody right now. This is Making Love by The Sloths, and we'll be right back, and we will listen to another song, which they have recorded recently. So check this out.
Only one thing I want to do. Baby, make love to you. I ain't looking to do you no harm. I want to hold you in my arms. I got to kiss you, gonna hold you tight. I want to be with you all night. Making love. Making love. Good, good, good love, baby. Making love. Oh, girl, don't put me down. Got no time, just mess around. Got the joy, can't conceal it. Baby, baby, do you feel it? You're gonna make me feel so fine. I'll be with you all the time, making love. Making love, baby. I'll feel so good. Ain't never gonna stop. When you come into my arms and you feel my hugging and you feel my kissing, then baby, you better know just how much you've been missing. Making love. Making love. Only one thing I want to do. Baby, baby, make love to you. I ain't looking to do no harm. I want to hold you in my arms. Gonna kiss you, gonna hold you tight. I'm gonna be with you all now. Making love. Making love. Making love all day and all night, baby. You got good loving. Good, 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 good loving, baby. You got good loving, baby. Making love now. Good loving, good, good, good. Wow, making love.
And that was Making Love by The Sloths, and you said that was recorded 1965, right?
Yep. Yep.
Okay. And this other track that I got, when did you record this?
Sorry?
This other track that I have, you said it was recorded recently. When did this get recorded?
Yeah, this is actually a cover song of the song My Little Red Book that Love did originally. And it was actually written by Burt Bacharach. Not a lot of people know that. And it was a kind of a sweet little Burt Bacharach number, and the group Love, you know, turned it into the kind of rocker that it was. And it was one of those, you know, like that and Satisfaction and, oh God, I'm a Man. And there was like certain songs that were the thing that every group did on the Sunset Strip. And so when we came back, you know, we said, we got to do this. And so this is a live version of us doing, you know, My Little Red Book. But it kind of gives you a feeling of what the group feels like now.
All right. And here it is, Little Red Book.
Goodbye. I come right through my little red book. I wasn't going to see you cry. Then I went from A to Z. I took out every pretty girl in town. They danced with me. And I held them. All of these was talking about you. Hear your name and I start to cry. It's just going to get over you. There ain't no girl in my little red book who could ever replace your song. And each girl in my little red book knows you're the one I'm thinking of. Oh, come back. Without your precious love, I can't go on. Oh,
We're back. And that was Tom McGlaughlin and his band Sloth jamming out that one, My Little Red Book. Awesome job, by the way.
What?
I said, awesome job, by the way.
Awesome.
It was kind of rocking out. We're going to have to wrap this up a little bit because we are really running out of time here, and we got another show that is live and is coming up at 7 o'clock, the Volcano Underground Radio Show. So we're going to go ahead and wrap this up. I thank you very much, sir, for joining me, and everybody in the chat room says hello, and thank you for being here because they enjoyed every minute that you were here.
And I send everybody my bloody best.